This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Of course, it doesn't matter, because if you can hack, you're going to give yourself the credit anyways. But I'm ching.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming our special guest for this week, Mary Alice McCarthy. Mary Alice, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Mary Alice is director of the Center on Education and Skills at New America. Also joining us, our skeptic on all things career and technical education. And all things in general. David Griffith.
I'll take it. Yep.
Welcome back, David. So good. Well, Mary Alice, first of all, how long have you been there at New America doing this work? Tell us a little bit about this, because we've had some New America folks on over the years. I think Kevin Carey included, though. It's probably been a while. But yeah, tell me, what are you doing over there?
Yeah, so I joined New America back in 2013 after doing a stint at the Department of Education and the Office of Career and Technical and Adult Education, and that was after a couple of years over at the Department of Labor. Yeah. So when I was in both federal agencies, I thought a lot about credentialing, a lot about career and technical education and workforce development and job training and how we make them all work together better, and that's really what the Center on Education and Skills is all about, is that intersection between CTE, workforce development, higher ed, and our more traditional education systems.
All right, well, let's talk about it. Let's do our Ed Reform update. All right. Well, Mary Alice, we have talked a lot about CTE on this show. I have become a big fan of high quality CTE, and it sort of now seems just banal. I mean, everybody now seems okay with it, even though just a few years ago in the education reform world, there was a lot of concern that this was a return to old style vocational training, that, that this was going to lead to tracking again, that there'd been a big push for college, meaning really 4-year college for everybody, at least as the goal. And okay, I guess if we get to the end of the process and some kids can't quite make it, then fine, we'll do CTE. There's been this big shift in saying, no, it actually makes a ton of sense starting in high school to allow kids to go and diverge on these different pathways, as long as the pathways are high quality.
Right.
And that they most likely that means going through some kind of post-secondary training and getting some kind of credential that's going to have value in the marketplace. So there's the agreement. You hear governors talking about this more and more. That all sounds easy to do, but it's, our sense that it's actually really hard. This is an area where the details matter a ton. So, and the skeptics would say, well, what are these credentials? There's like thousands of workplace credentials out there now that all kinds of groups are offering. So how do we make sure that these things are actually going to have value in the labor market? Can you start to fill in these holes for us?
Yeah, and I really think you put your finger on the big, both the big opportunity and the big challenge with all of the innovation we've seen in credentialing. Because credentials can be a very valuable way for people to be able to signal and communicate their skills to employers, and they can sort of reduce those kinds of, transaction costs, we might say, between people who know things and employers who are looking for things. And when schools, whether they're high schools or colleges or universities, can sort of embed those types of competency-based credentials that are really good signals into their programs, they really can enrich their programs. But the problem is, particularly when we're talking about credentials like certifications and occupational licenses, and in some cases certificates, the colleges and high schools and universities need to know which ones are valuable and which ones aren't if they're going to put them in their degree programs. And if you're a student, particularly if you're like a community college student, you're going to have lots of opportunities, or a student in post-secondary education, you're going to have lots of opportunities to sort of enroll in some certificate program or certification program just on its own as a standalone. How do you know whether or not that program's worth your money? And that's where policy has a big role to play.
Give some examples of what sort of good and bad ones are. I mean, I feel like I read at some point that some places were giving credit for kids getting like a first aid certification, for example.
Right.
Which certainly seems a whole lot different than an AA degree in nursing. I mean, there's a world of difference. And yet, in some state accountability systems, as we try to measure, high schools, are they getting kids to get valuable credentials? Maybe the first aid thing ends up getting counted, which is ridiculous. I mean, is this the problem that we're talking about?
Well, that's certainly one of the problems. There is just huge variability in the value of these credentials to individuals, and just and in terms of the learning outcomes that they kind of attest to, or the skills that they attest to. And so we do have next to each other, we'll have sort of, you've got a certificate in CPR is one type of credential, but then you also might
By the way, it's great for kids to know CPR. I don't want to
absolutely. Or an OSHA certificate, but they have a very different purpose than, for example, like a certification in sort of C++ or A++ or, yeah, you know, an IT certification, yeah, or a cybersecurity certification, like mm-hmm. the ethical hacker certification. These are certifications that attest to very advanced skills and are extremely yeah. valuable in the labor market. Now, these can all be valuable, but they just have to be put into the right context. They have to be financed in the right way, and people have to know what they are and what mm-hmm. they're getting into. So there are some states that are doing a great job at creating lists of high quality credentials mm-hmm. or high quality certifications and licenses.
Okay.
And then crosswalking those to either college credit or high school credit to give schools and consumers and students and families a sense of like, yeah, how many, probably a first aid or a CPR certificate isn't worth necessarily college credit, but the certification as an ethical hacking probably is, because yeah. it corresponds very closely to what's actually yeah. in the curriculum of an associate.
Of course, it doesn't matter, because if you can hack, you're going to give yourself the credit anyways. But I'm ching. Yeah, just kidding.
Sorry. Oh boy, set myself up.
Right. Yeah.
Cut
yeah.
that part.
All right. So is this a state role then in basically making these lists that is essentially has to be the government that says these are in and these are out?
Well, I think they're just the best position. States are really well positioned to create these lists. I think Florida has really shown us how it's done with the, they have this program called the Career and Professional Education Act, the mm-hmm. CAPE Act, that they passed it back in 2007, where then the state went through a very rigorous process leveraging its education and workforce data mm-hmm. to figure out, and its sort of ability to sort of convene employers and using mm-hmm. its public workforce system to talk to employers about what were the credentials that really mattered to them mm-hmm. to create a list of certifications and certificates that they were willing to reimburse mm-hmm. high schools and colleges for, if their students completed those. Mm-hmm. So that way the high schools and colleges could embed these mm-hmm. certifications and certificates into the programs with the knowledge that, first of all, somebody has to pay for taking those certification yeah. exams. It allowed them to do that and to know that, first of all, that this was a credential that actually had labor market yeah. value. It had been vetted by the state. And then on top of it, they wouldn't have to charge the student for it or try to somehow figure out how to, work it into their tuition or fees. They would get reimbursed by the state for it.
David, this all sounds great. What's your beef, Mr. Grumpy Man?
Yeah, look, what you're saying makes a lot of sense to me mm-hmm. as you're saying it. It's a complicated discussion. It's a complicated case for CTE or against CTE, because frankly, it's bringing a lot of different things together.
Yeah.
I mean, at the highest level, I think what bothers me a little bit, right? And stop me if you've heard this before, is there's a giant pendulum feel to all this, right? Mm-hmm. Like first, the entire education ed reform movement was sprinting for 4-year college, right? And now we're sprinting back, in precisely yeah. the opposite direction towards every kid's got to have a CTE, credential by the time yeah. they graduate from high school. And, I mean, it should be obvious that, right, like we're searching for the right balance. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you can't be against career and technical education, right? A JD is a form of career education. An MD mm-hmm. is, a PhD mm-hmm. is. Everybody eventually needs career education.
Yeah.
As you were talking, I guess the big question for me is like, so why high school, right? Like, does it have to start in high school? Like, what's wrong with an associate degree? Doesn't every kid, I thought every kid kind of needed all the stuff we were giving them in high school. Mm-hmm. And if it has to start in high school, like, kind of what's on the chopping block?
Yeah, well, that's right. And that's, look, I mean, Eric Hanyschik and Ludger Wossmann have made this argument with some of the international data. You look at Germany, that people went through the vocational track that helps them in the short term, but maybe not the long term, as they have to learn new skills. There's all this talk about the age of agility. We need people to be able to, that a liberal arts kind of background is going to be important.
That's the other thing that's weird to me about it, Mike, right? It's like, we keep reading all these stories that say, the job market is increasingly dynamic.
Right.
People are changing jobs more and more often.
Yep.
And the response is, let's train kids for the first job they're going to get, out of 15.
Oh, all right. You make some good points, Mary Alice.
Yeah. Well, no, those are great points. But I do think that that's not how the field, certainly it's not how the career and technical education field is thinking about narrowing. And I do think, though, we need to be careful about that. So why high school, first of all? I would say, I don't think anybody's saying that all high school students should earn certifications and sort of career technical technical certificates, but that for some students, they want to learn that way. They want to have hands-on experience. And we already know from the data that CTE can be a really good high school retention and high school mm-hmm. completion strategy. And this just adds an additional level of rigor. If you have high quality industry certifications into those programs, it just means that they're probably more rigorous than they would be without them. So it's an opportunity opportunity to introduce more rigor into these high school CTE programs. I completely agree. But I also think that, yes, there's this kind of, you know, in terms of the pendulum swinging, I think that's a really interesting point. We talk about it as like, you know, it's like we've gone from college for all to let's completely unbundle the bachelor's degree and put it into a bunch of discrete parts. And again, that's not what we're seeing in places like Florida that are, the state is creating a policy environment and a financing environment in which colleges then can figure out ways to bring these to rebundle their associate degree program so that they include not just a degree, but also valuable industry certifications. And that's exciting.
And then the last piece here seems to be getting employers to stop requiring the bachelor's degree for jobs that don't actually require a bachelor's degree. Do we see any progress on that front?
I think that there's growing awareness. I will say our research indicates, too, it's also getting employers to even understand what role things like certifications can play for them and what are valuable certifications. There's just, again, there's so much confusion out there. But I think that we are seeing a growing awareness within HR offices and C-suites that they need to think about skills more than skill, you know, how to verify certain kinds of skills and that different types of credentials can get them there. But I also think that there's ways, the bachelor's degree is still a very valuable credential and the one that we should be sort of putting people on the path toward.
Yeah.
The question is, can we create more ways and different ways for people to get there through different types of credentialing pathways?
All right. Wow, such a great conversation. One of the best conversations on CTE I've ever heard. If I say so myself, Mary Alice McCarthy again. Thanks for joining us, Director of the Center on Education and Skills at New America. Thanks so much, Mary Alice. Hope you come back sometime.
Thank you. I'd love to.
Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
You haven't been back since the big news in Virginia. You got Amazon.
A lot of people aren't happy about that. Some people are, but
yeah.
We have a distribution center out in Richmond, so I guess this is like the real deal. What is this in Virginia?
HQ 2.5 or something like that.
Right.
Yes. Yet more one more reason for people to hate the Washington area.
Yeah.
Corporate welfare.
I don't order from Amazon. I'm the very small percentage of people who do.
Really?
I do not.
You never order from
they
Amazon?
They hacked my...
How do you eat?
This is a long story, but they hacked my debit account.
Oh, right.
After I canceled Prime because we weren't using Prime, and then they hacked my husband's debit account, and then they got on my credit card. Like, it was insane. I kept seeing Prime bills everywhere. I got very upset.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, long drawn out story, but I finally got everything credited, but it left me with a sour feeling for Amazon.
I would think so. Whereas when I come home and I see that Amazon box and I just think, oh, I'm so excited. What did I order 3 days ago? I can't quite remember, right. But I'm excited.
3 days,
to open
it gets
up.
There right, like 2 hours
ago.
Now.
Well, it's true. I get groceries now. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Future Mike has a lot of surprises in store for him.
I know. Yeah. I do. But anyways, I don't mean for this to be a commercial for Amazon, but hey, yes. Bezos, you know, we haven't gotten any money from the Bezos Foundation yet. And we'd be interested in talking to them about that.
Hope you didn't hear me just trash Amazon. Yeah. Anyhow.
We digress. What do we got?
We're going to talk about student tests today. It's not only apparently a big debate in the United States, but apparently across the entire globe, at least say Eric Hanischek and Ludger Wussmann. And they actually look at, in the recent NBR paper, I had not seen this when it came out over the summer. Do you remember this, Mike? Anyway, over the summer, they examine how tests are implemented worldwide and in what ways their implementation promotes higher achievement.
Mm.
They perform their analysis at the individual student level, building a data set of over 2 million students in 59 countries. Observed over six waves of international administration of the PISA test from 2000 through 2015.
Okay.
Why did we not see this? I don't know.
Yeah.
PISA.
But you never come out with a new product in August. Come on, people.
I think PISA, most people know it's an international test for 15-year-olds. It covers math, science, and reading. Analysts also pull from an array of survey data that accompany PISA, typically completed by the school leader. They ask these guys a ton of stuff. They consider three dimensions of student test. First, the strength of the testing incentives, meaning whether results are used for external comparisons or monitoring of teachers or schools or just public reporting to the parents or mm-hmm. internal tracking. There's all these different indicators of what it can mean to be how strong the incentive is.
Okay.
Second, whether the incentives are focused on schools or students.
Mm-hmm.
And third, the school environment, which basically means the school poverty level. Okay, they look at sort of how it plays out with that, with the poverty level. They used a fixed effects panel model, which includes country and year fixed effects, and that essentially identifies the effect of assessment policies on student achievement from policy changes within countries over time.
Mm-hmm.
David got that. Mike, did you get that?
Yeah, I did. All right. Yep, policy changes over time.
They go into great detail describing the rich set of student, school, and country background factors that they use. And the idea here is that these things essentially take out the country-specific variation over time to the extent that all these observable things can be controlled. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But do they satisfy the assumption of parallel trends?
They do.
Amber?
They do. They do. They have a good page on how they satisfy that. The key finding is that testing systems that use standardized tests to compare outcomes across schools and students produce greater student outcomes. So that comparative feature. For example, a change from not using a standardized test for external comparison to doing so is linked to an increase in math achievement of more than one quarter of a standard deviation. These systems that compare student outcomes also tend to have consequential implications, and they produce higher achievement than the systems that simply report the results to parents directly, perhaps on a report card.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Which is what we've in effect moved to.
Kind of.
In many states.
Yeah. They also produce greater results than systems that rely on local test, meaning just teacher test or formative test or any of those other things. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, we got to think this is internet, this is across the world. So think about the everything they're trying to capture here. And they say that those local tests, teacher tests, formative tests have actually little impact on student achievement.
Mm-hmm.
Introducing only internal tests for the purpose of teacher monitoring is also showed no results. Okay. Mm. If that's just the purpose, you're going to monitor your teacher somehow with these test results, or using tests, in the form of inspectorates, Mike, that was interesting. The use of inspectorates also did not affect student achievement. They also find that both accountability at the school level, again, meaning that those school results are compared for across the district or nation, and accountability at the student level. In this case, that means a little bit tough because, again, how they define these things kind of gets a little hazy. Mm-hmm. But student level here means whether test results are used to place students at the lower secondary level. Or consequences at the end of the secondary school level. So I'm guessing some kind of
SAT.
Testing, placement test.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those result in greater learning.
Mm-hmm.
However, accountability at the school level yields even stronger results.
Interesting.
Finally, I'm getting close here. The impact of having standardized tests used to compare schools is stronger in lower achieving countries and decreases as scores increase. So specifically at an initial country level of 400 PISA points, the introduction of a standardized test for external comparison purposes leads to an increase in achievement of about 37% of a standard deviation in math. With each 100 more initial PISA points, this effect is reduced by about 24% of a standard deviation.
And, fascinating.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then they have...
No, but you see the same thing here. I mean, in that we've always had the biggest impact of accountability on the lowest performing kids and the sort of...
Yeah, but we've also
lowest performing schools.
Kids, right?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, that's pretty much it. They have a short discussion about, you know, the importance of international comparisons in here that, you know, when you compare schools, essentially that's what they kind of found in, you know, different formats that that's going to enhance student achievement.
Wow. That's big.
Right. Now, there's a lot going on there.
A lot going on.
So let me see if I can summarize. There have to be stakes. They can either be for the school or for the student. But if there are no stakes, it doesn't really matter.
That's right.
And it seems like the school might work even better than the student. And potentially, I guess the higher achieving the kids are or the country is, the more there's a culture of high achievement. The less it sort of matters?
Maybe.
Is that the right interpretation of that last bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the test-based accountability can set a floor, right? It helps schools go from bad to good. It doesn't do much for going from good to great.
Great.
I mean, that's been our experience in this country, I think. Although, you know, you look at Massachusetts and say, you know, what happened there where there was going from good to great? Was that the accountability or was that maybe a bunch of the other stuff they did?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we know they were amping up what it means to be proficient every, you know, every couple of years.
Okay,
right?
But that's more accountability, right? I mean, it could have been capacity building stuff, right? A strong curriculum.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you're saying that like, for a country, if an entire country is higher achieving, then test-based accountability has less of an impact.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
I mean, to me, that it feels like it has to be something outside the system then, right? I don't know. Something to do with like how, I don't know. It's the most interesting finding and the hardest to unpack.
I don't know. I think partly, to me, it just makes sense to say that accountability or any policy, you know, you can't generate excellence via policy per se, other than sort of, you know, hiring really great teachers and letting, giving them more autonomy, you know, empowering them. I mean, I think I think we kind of know that once you get to, you know, if you're trying to go for great, it's about great talent and with really good tools and then empowerment, right? Versus this, you know, you've got some schools that are just, you know, doing nothing or horrific,
not going to keep getting that bump year after year after year.
I agree with with the first half of that. I think the only thing I would say is it could also be about things that are outside of the school, right? The culture of education, how motivated the kids are, the parents. But I do agree with the part which is you can't test your way to excellence.
So the other cynical view would say, well, so what? So, you know, countries that have a lot of testing, their kids do better on tests. So what? I mean,
is this Mike Petrilli?
I know. So answer the question, Amber. Yeah. Explain so what? As Andy said, has shown, right?
It did relate to right, and GDP and these other things, exactly. The economy and
skills. It's not just the kids are learning to do better on tests, but they seem to actually have higher skills, and these skills translate into better results in terms of economic growth.
Economics. That's right. That's right. That wasn't what this study was about, but yes, his other work has most definitely found that. Yes.
Excellent. Yeah. Why is nobody talking about the study?
Where did was you find the it? Study? It was an NBR working paper this summer. Came out in July.
So where did somebody show it? What was it? Check.
Well, I go around and look for this stuff, Mike.
Well, good work. Good work. It is very interesting. Now, I guess, you know, the big question, if it's an MBER, that seems like that means something, but surely it's a challenge to try to figure out.
Ed didn't pick it up or anything. I don't know. I feel like people, I don't know if it's international bias against international research, which we tend to have that, you know, but here, like, it seems
like
it makes
now
sense.
The world knows about it. Thank you, Amber. Good. Yes. Good. Excellent. Fascinating stuff. All right. Well, that is all the time we've got for this week. Until next week,
I'm Dave Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.